to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We're poor, Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Munda civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, oh my God, oh Madre de Dios, who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves, became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Dr.
John Henry Clark, John Dr. Jackson, Muhammad. Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
It's from a book called Wise. WHY apostrophe S, WISE, Africa, mighty, ancient, beautiful Africa. Creator of the human being, of speech, of music, of the dance, ancient, mighty Africa, beautiful Africa. But when you put your hand on your sister, made her a slave, watch out, Africa. Watch out, Africa, the ghost's gonna get you. When you put your hand on your brother, made him a slave, watch out, Africa. Watch out, Africa. The ghost's gonna get you. Ah! How did I get here on my back in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears? How did I get here in the dark? How did I get here in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears? Watch out, Obatala, Shango, save me. Save me, Isa, save me. How did I get here on my back? In the dark, with the wind and water blowing through my ears, my brother the king sold me to the ghost. My brother the king sold me to the ghost. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. Black ivory. Wise one. If you ever find yourself somewhere lost and surrounded by enemies who won't let you speak in your own language, who destroy your statues and instruments, who ban your umbu baum, you're in trouble. They ban your umbu baum, you in deep, deep trouble. Huh. probably take you several hundred years to get out. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. Black ivory, black ivory, black ivory, black ivory. Thank you, Steve. Rob Brown.
Hotep, and good afternoon, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, Dr. William Rogers. So happy that you could join us today, this evening, for another hopefully stimulating and exciting program. Today we're going to talk about the great and powerful Paul Robeson. We are based at the Time for an Awakening network system, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 Eastern Time to 10 Eastern Time, or 7 Central Time to 9 Central Time. And we are so happy to be here with you again this afternoon, this evening. We got a wonderful panel of conversationists that always join us that's going to be here. We're going to talk about this dynamic activism and the power of this dear brother, and why we must never, ever, ever want to forget him. There are those that we know would like for us to forget him, but we can't. And so we want to be able to do that, pass that on to our children. Our ancestors are our hope, and we stand on their shoulders, and we praise them dearly. We thank you so much. A lot is, again, as always, lots going on, of course. I just want to stop. This past week, we've lost several dear and friends and brothers that a lot of us know in different parts of the country. In the Milwaukee area, we lost a dear brother who was a very active young man who was very powerful as well. He had done so much. He was in a very bad car accident this past Saturday, Brother Caesar Stinson. And so we want to send our shouts out to his family. We wish them condolences if they are listening. If there's anybody that knows them, you can pass that on. Our dear brother has transitioned to the ancestral world and had an opportunity to talk with Caesar extensively over the years and bonded with him in many, many ways. And then, as we all know, the Kobe Bryant, the basketball player who lost his life and his daughter in a plane crash, a helicopter crash as well. And they were both taken also to that ancestral realm. And then also our dear brother that has often been on the Black Reality Think Tank talk program, Brother Russell Stamper, Judge Russell Stamper, his wife transitioned this week as well. And then in North Carolina, we lost two very dear friends, Brother Henry Gunn, who transitioned a couple of days ago, and also Brother Leon Cole, who was a very dynamic and dear friend, raised all my life with them in a section of Durham, North Carolina, called Brookstown. So, yeah, a lot of our folk have been called on to the ancestor world, so I guess you just have to be ready. And I just wanted to shout out to them and their families, at least, and wish them, give them my condolences on behalf of the Black Reality Think Tank. I notice for those of you who are listening via internet, the internet's a little choppy. I see that it's jumping in and out. Unfortunately, there's nothing that we can do. As a lot of times it has to do with the weather. And we are broadcasting still in Wisconsin. And the weather is always challenging. And so the internet's jumping a little bit. But in any case, if you do miss some things, you know, our program is archived. It continues to broadcast in that realm. And those of you who are on the switchboard, you're going to still hopefully be able to continue to listen as well. So if it goes in and out, that's what's happening. Also, we want to just mention that our program is sponsored by Motherland Media Network, which is a part of a program that also airs called African Perspectives. Brother Oshiemi Adelabu is the head of that group. He has been sponsoring the Black Reality Think Tank. And the Black Reality Think Tank is also produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. And we thank all of those that are involved in making this possible. And we are going to continue to grow. We hopefully we will continue to be able to provide you with interesting dialogue and discussion and hopefully your feedback and get your feedback on a consistent basis. We thank you all so much again for your participation and what you do. We're going to get ready to get into our discussion. I'm going to talk a little bit about and give it our ancestral profile. We don't do anything on this program without honoring our ancestors. And so what we would like to do is continue that focus and that process. And then we're going to turn our attention to Brother Paul Robeson and talk a little bit about him and his work and why it's so necessary that we write our own history and make sure that we can tell our own story. You know, that's what we must do. We must tell our own story from our own perspective. And so very soon, in the next couple of weeks, a lot of the country will be celebrating what's called African American History Month, created by the great Carter Woodson. However, we have began here at the Black Reality Think Tank, we embrace that is a 365-day event for us. And but however, if you only do focus in on just one month out of the year, then by all means, hopefully you will be able to enlighten others as you attempt to try to learn about our people and yourself. And that's really what you're doing. You're learning about yourself. So tonight I want to talk about a sister, very dynamic sister. Her name is Charlotta A. Bass. Charlotta A. Bass, B-A-S-S. She was a contemporary of the subject matter tonight, Paul Robeson. But I just wanted to mention some of the things that she did. Charlotta Bass was an educator. She was a newspaper publisher and editor and civil rights activist. Sister Bass was probably the first African-American woman to own and operate her own newspaper in the United States. She published a paper called The California Eagle from 1912 until 1951. In 1952, Charlotta Bass became the first African-American woman nominated for vice president of the United States of America as a candidate of the Progressive Party. Born Charlotta Amanda Spears in Sumter, South Carolina, in 1879 or 1880, not quite sure, Bass was the sixth of seven children. And at the turn of the century, Sister Bass moved to Rhode Island. And in 1910, she migrated to California, Los Angeles, to improve her health. John James Nemour had established a newspaper in California called the California Owl newspaper. And he did this in 1879 in Los Angeles. He did it as a way to ease black settlers' transition to the West. The paper provided them with housing and job information and other information essential to surviving in a new environment. When arriving in California, Charlotta was first employed by the California Owl, selling subscriptions, and soon she was wearing multiple hats. She was not only selling subscriptions, she was writing, editing, and doing anything else that she was asked to do or needed to do for this newspaper. Fulfilling the deathbed request of the publisher, Sister Bass became the Owl's editor and publisher in March of 1912. It was a career lasting over 40 years until she sold the newspaper in 1951. In 1914, Charlotta hired and subsequently married Joseph Blackburn Bass, a Kansas newspaper man, who edited the paper until his death in 1934. They eventually changed the name of the paper to the California Eagle. The couple had no children, but Charlotta Bass was very close to her nephew, John Kinloch. John Kinloch, who also worked at the paper. The California Eagle evolved into one of the leading newspapers of the day while under the control of Charlotta A. Bass and her husband, John Bass. The California Eagle had a tradition of fighting for racial equality and against discrimination. And Sister Bass continued this tradition under her leadership. During the early 1900s, California had attracted many African-American settlers who were heading west in search of better economic opportunities than were available in the South. The black community in Los Angeles was growing rapidly, and African Americans experienced high home ownership rates in the booming city. However, Bass and other African American intellectuals, such as W.B. Du Bois, were not shy to point out that while California offered many opportunities for blacks, there was still a considerable amount of discrimination, as expected. In 1914, articles and editorials were published in opposition to the making of the movie by D.W. Griffin called Birth of a Nation and its derogatory portrayals of African Americans and celebratory depiction of the Ku Klux Klan violence. This campaign was joined by other African American newspapers across the nation, led to the banning of Birth of a Nation in some communities. As the editor and publisher of the California Eagle, Charlotta Bass fought against restrictive covenants in housing and segregated schools in Los Angeles. She had also taken part in successful campaigns to end job discrimination at the Los Angeles General Hospital, the Los Angeles Rapid Transit Company, the Southern Telephone Company, and the Boulder Dam Project. Charlotta Bass was president of the Los Angeles Division of the Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association during the early 1920s and was a West Coast promoter of the Don't Buy Where You Can't Work campaign of the mid to late 1930s. Bass paid a price for her outspokenness. Her life was threatened on numerous occasions. The FBI placed her under surveillance on the charge that her newspaper was seditious and continued to monitor her until her death. She was accused of being a communist in 1950. She was also called before the California legislature. Those of who are on the line, if your mic is open, I can hear anything that you're saying, so please let me. I apologize, folks. Let me silence that, because in some cases I can hear you very clearly. Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Brother Timothy, you have to... When you do that, you have to, keep that low, keep your voice low. Okay. All right. Let me continue. As I said, she paid a price for that, and she caused a lot of trouble for her and the newspaper. Bass wrote her last column for the California Eagle on April 26, 1951, and sold the paper soon after. Charlotte wrote, "It has been a good life that I have had through a very hard one, but I know the future will be even better." And as I think back, I know that that is the only kind of life in serving one's fellow man, one serves himself best. When the California Eagle shut down the presses in 1954, it was one of the oldest black-owned and operated papers in the United States. Bass devoted her remaining years in politics. In 1952, Charlotta Bass served as the national chairman of the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, which was an organization of black women set up to protest racial violence in the South. After years as a registered Republican, she left the party in 1946 in the Progressive Party presidential campaign of 1952. Charlotta Bass was the running mate of lawyer Benson Hallinan. Charlotta Bass ran for several elected offices, including the Los Angeles City Council Congress and the U.S. Vice Presidency. She was also a founding member of California's Independent Progressive Party part of the National Progressive Party, which was a third-party movement. Moreover, she founded, led, and participated in numerous civil rights organizations. In the early 1960s, Charlotta Bass retired and moved to Lake Elsinore, California, where she continued her civil rights activism. She turned her garage into a community reading room and a voter registration site for African Americans, and joined protests against South African apartheid and on behalf of prisoner rights. Charlotta Bass transitioned on April 12, 1969, at the age of 95. Charlotta Bass. This was a very dynamic sister. One of the things that we've often spoke about is the power of the black press and what the black press can do. We did do a program sometime back, maybe about a year or so ago. I think it's time to revisit again the black press, talk about it, even though today it has really gone, it has died down. There's very few black newspapers left in the country. One of the largest ones, biggest ones that operates out of Chicago was the Chicago Defender. It was really the only daily black newspaper. And it began to dwindle, and they had to, reduce the size and start doing it once a week. And now any of those that are still existing, most of them are distributed through the Internet. The technology has definitely made a difference in the lives of those papers. But they are very powerful for our community. Another thing is that a lot of it is dealing with advertising. If an African-American paper attempted to take on a crusade against some form of injustice, then more than likely their revenue would be cut because many of the advertisers would refuse to do that. I had the opportunity in Milwaukee to work for a black press for some time. It was a very powerful experience. Got a chance to do some real big things and able to make a difference, in the lives of a lot of folk that I knew here. But at the same time, it has to be supported, and the community has to do that. So we need to take a look at our black press, support it when we can. If we can't, then at least try to encourage others to do that. So anyway, that was a very dynamic. She was also Charlotta Bass was worked very closely with Paul Robeson during those years that he was involved in a lot of the labor disputes and some of the things that he was actively a part of as well. And so I wanted to make sure that we talked about it. So tonight we're talking about a dear brother. His name is Paul Leroy Robeson. And he was particular about you pronouncing his last name right, Robeson. It's R-O-B-E, like a robe, rope, and then son, Robeson. And he challenged several people about the proper use of his name. But let's just talk a little bit about him before we get into really the articulate discussion about what he was doing in his life. He was born April 9th, 1898, in Princeton, New Jersey. He was the son of a former enslaved African who became an educated minister, and his mother was a Quaker. The Reverend William Drew Robeson and Maria Louisa Bustill. The Bustills were a prominent Philadelphia family with a storied history. Maria's great-grandfather, who was a baker, supplied bread to Washington's army during the Revolutionary War and founded a mutual aid society for African people. In 1933, a magazine wrote asking Robeson for the correct pronunciation of his last name. He said his name is robe, as the ordinary word robe, meaning dress, and son, pronounced like the word son. Robeson attended Rutgers College on an academic scholarship. He played five sports and won recognition as an All-American football player. He was elected to the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society, and he graduated valedictorian of his class at a time when most African Americans were denied even entrance to white colleges. And even so, he was tormented on the gridiron. One player crushed his cleats into Robeson's hand, tearing loose some of his fingernails. Robeson persevered, and after Rutgers, he attended law school at Columbia University in New York. He got a job at a local law firm after graduation. He left after the firm's stenographer refused to take dictation from him because he was black. He found his way back into the theater, where he had appeared in the all-black play Shuffle Along and other musicals while in law school, and he never looked back. He met his future wife, Eslanda Cardozo Good, who was also from a prominent family while in law school in the 1920s. They had a son, whom they named Paul Jr. Robeson. Essie, as she was called, became a noted anthropologist, author, and civil rights activist alongside her husband. Rutgers University's photo of Paul Robeson as a football player in the school Robeson career spanned nearly 50 years, starting in 1915 at Rutgers. He went on to become a prolific entertainer, both in the United States and abroad, playing the title role in Othello, Showboat, The Emperor Jones, and other Broadway plays. He recorded albums, and he filled concert halls. Early on, Robeson was one of the best-paid performers in the country. He brought African-American spirituals to people who did not see it as a serious musical form. He held several concerts and shows in Philadelphia, where his sister, Marion Forsythe, lived. His accompanist of 40 years was Lawrence Benjamin Brown, who was a composer of spirituals. Brown accompanied Robeson on tours and recordings. Robeson came to Philadelphia for many performances. In the winter of 1924-25, he appeared in The Emperor Jones at the Walnut Street Theater. In the 1940s, he sang spirituals at the Robin Hood Deli East Outdoor Arena with a turnout of one concert of more than 7,500 people. He also sang with the Philadelphia Orchestra on several occasions. Robeson performed John Henry at the Erlanger Theater in 1939. He sang and spoke at a Progressive Party rally in 1948 in Shire Park in support of presidential candidate Henry Wallace. His mindset and popularity changed, however, after he first went to Russia in 1934 and found that he was treated better there than in the United States. He spoke in support of workers. Just a second. I'm sorry. Okay. He spoke in favor, you know, of workers and common people, both abroad and in this country, and he marched against discrimination. He said, "Here I am, not a Negro, but a human being for the first time in my life. I work in full human dignity," he told reporters along his experience in Russia. His actions made him a pariah in the eyes of many. J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI put Robeson and Eslander under surveillance in 1941. It lasted until Robeson died in Philadelphia in 1976. The House Un-American Activities Committee called him to testify as a perceived communist in 1956, and the State Department revoked his passport in 1950, preventing him from traveling abroad for concerts that had helped provide for his salary. Paul Robeson and Eslander Good Robeson. Many of Robeson's concerts were canceled. Record companies were no longer interested in recording his songs. His income dropped from six figures to four. He suffered both financially and health-wise. During his appearance before the House Committee, Eslander was also called, and her passport was also revoked. He refused to answer a question about whether or not he was a communist. Instead, he said, "I'm not being tried for whether I am a communist. I am being tried for fighting for the rights of my people, who are still second-class citizens in this United States of America. You want to shut up every Negro who has the courage to stand up and fight for the rights of his people, for the rights of workers, and I have been on many a picket line for the steel workers, too. and that is why I'm here today, he told a group of protesters. Paul Robeson, at a 1948 protest march with the Civil Rights Congress in support of an anti-lynching law, an end to poll tax, and more. A U.S. Supreme Court ruling in a similar case in 1958 reinstated the couple's passport. Robeson eventually regained some of his stature, but he and his accomplishments are still not fully recognized or acknowledged, even till today. In 1966, Robeson came to Philadelphia and remained here until the protective eye of his sister Mary Ann until his death in 1976. That's just a little bit about Paul Robeson. There's so much other vast information about him and his work. Just to kind of help, I remember several incidents involving Paul Robeson as a young man, even as a kid. Some I remember that I don't necessarily, I was young enough, but I remember living in Durham, North Carolina. He was the guest at what was called at the time North Carolina College for Negroes at Durham. Well, actually it was called North Carolina College for Teachers, and it was in Durham, North Carolina, and now it's called North Carolina Central. He was there to perform. The name of the auditorium at North Carolina Central was called the B.N. Duke Auditorium, obviously named after the Duke family, who were beneficiaries to a lot of the buildings there on the college based on Dr. James E. Shepherd's work that he had done. But the concert was sold out. And he came out on stage and the curtain opened. And he walked out to begin his performance, and he looked out into the audience, and he stopped, and everybody couldn't figure out what was going on. And he looked into the audience, and he looked up in the balcony, and he said, am I in the right place? He said, is this North Carolina College for Negroes? And somebody said, yes, sir, yes, it is. He said, well, why are all these white people sitting down here in the front and all the Negroes sitting up there in the balcony? I don't understand that. And as a result of that, he walked off the stage and refused to sing. And my father told me that story. He was there. It was before my time. He was there. And my mother, and they were part of that. And he walked off. Everybody was upset. They were saying all kind of different things. But that's the kind of man that Paul Robeson was. He was a man of stature and principle. And his work was very strong. He would case. I want to just mention, and then I'm going to kind of open up, give folks, those of you who were here, the chance to kind of talk a little bit about his activism, because this same type of activism is necessary today. The same discrimination that he faced, you would face today if you tried to do that. So we ask ourselves, what's changed? So I just want to mention a few little bit of what I always like to do. I always like to mention our resources and where a lot of the information is coming from and where you can find some of the information if you attempted to look a little bit further. The one thing that I do remember, I remember in high school, and you know how you do book reports, and you know how you have to do, you come up and you do reports. And I wanted to do a report on Paul Robeson. And I can't remember, I think I might have been about 10th, 11th grade. And when I got ready to stand up, I said, I'm going to do my report on Paul Robeson. And the teacher at the time said, no, you can't do Paul Robeson. And I said, why not? You know, obviously at that time you didn't talk back. So I didn't say, I said, but why? He said, because I said so. And so I had to put it down and I went home. When I went home, I told my mother, I wanted to do Paul Robeson. They wouldn't let me do it. And she was a teacher, said either. She said, you should have asked me that because I would have told you not to do that. I said, but why? I didn't understand why. And that I couldn't do Paul Robeson. And that was because of the fact that, you know, the accusations about him and the Communist Party and so forth. And I don't remember a lot of black history programs where we talked about Paul Robeson. We talked about Paul Lawrence Dunbar, obviously, Frederick Douglass, you know, those kind of people. Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. Very rarely did we go to people like him. We definitely did not talk about Marcus Garvey. That's totally, I didn't even know who Marcus Garvey was until I had left high school. That was not a discussion. And you must remember I was raised in the segregated South. I went to all segregated schools. And you just certain people, even among our teachers, that you just didn't, they didn't talk about. I do remember Zora Neale Hurston, but not a whole lot. No, it wasn't a lot of that. And so there were a lot of them that were censored at our level, and I could not. And one of the first things that introduced me to Paul Robeson was his book called Here I Stand. And if any of you have not read that, I would highly suggest that you do. It is a very dynamic autobiography of him, and it would be enjoyable for you, and I'm sure, to get a chance to do that. I want to also mention a couple of other books. Paul Robeson Jr., his son, he wrote a book called Paul Robeson, Tributes and Selected Writings. Paul Robeson also did a lot of collection of his speeches and his writings, and his interviews were all put into books for him, for those made those available. I'm sure that probably a lot of libraries censored that at the time, you know, and maybe at some point, I don't know when it entered back into the intellectual mainstream. Paul Robeson also did something called New Idealism, he wrote a piece there. And then there are a lot of biographies that were done by him. One of the ones that the academic community embraces, I actually have not read it. I've looked at it. It's a book by Martin Dubberman. He wrote in 1989 called Paul Robeson. That's the one that if people talk about him, they'll quote that book. Dubberman was a European-American, obviously, and he talked about a lot of things in terms of the Communist Party things. And then there's another one by Paul Robeson Jr. that he did 2001. This is his son again. It's called The Undiscovered Paul Robeson, An Artist's Journey from 1898 to 1939. Now, that is a good one. I did read that book, and that's written by his son. So those are some materials. Now, obviously, you can go back in our archive at the end of this if you didn't write that down and be able to do it. But these are excellent materials that would help you understand Paul Robeson a little bit better. There's another one by a Hicks historian. His name is Donald Bogle. He wrote a book called Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks, An Interpretive History of Blacks in American Film. And see, there was some controversy about the role that Paul Robeson played, for instance, in Showboat, where he used the Negro dialect to sing Old Man River and some of the other songs in that fashion. He was criticized in some cases by this behavior, and even in The Emperor Jones, there's writings that he was criticized in terms of playing that role and how it was played. But very clearly, there were folk, if you knew Paul Robeson, you knew that that was not what he was doing. And even though those roles may have been demeaning a little bit, it was not there. Manny Marable also did a piece called W.B. Du Bois, Black Radical Democrat, which he talks about Paul Robeson a lot. Lauren McConnell does one called Understanding Paul Robeson's Soviet Experience. And there are some things that you really would need to look at and to clearly be able to understand what he was doing. Everybody that, and a lot of folk were embracing the Communist Party at the time. For instance, Richard Wright clearly was hugging that, and he was hugging the ideology because they thought that that might be a way to freedom. You know, because obviously the American system wasn't giving in to anything. And so a lot of folk chose to go that route. And then even he was criticized in some cases by some critics. But again, people are going to always do that for his role in Othello and the tragic story of the Othello character that was written by Shakespeare. And so those are just some books. There's a lot more. Sterling Stuckey, the African-American literary critic, did one called Going Through the Storm, The Influence of African-American Art and History, talking about, you know, some of the things that we had to do in getting it published and moving it forward. Charles Wright, H. Wright, wrote a book called Roberson's Labors, Roberson, Labor's Forgotten Champion. He was an advocate fighter of the cause of labor. And he stood tall in that. And that's probably one of the most powerful activist contributions that that he did make. And again, he lived to see the civil rights movement as well. He sang in many concerts. And it's just a lot of history of Paul Robeson. It's so unfortunate that our children did not get this, and our children today are still not getting this. And if you have any power at all, anywhere you are, we must demand that the educational system embrace, you know, that kind of thing with Paul Robeson. One of the things I think I want to be able to mention that as we open up our discussion and talk about this activism today is being able to see how that fits in with us. A lot of our things have become very, we've been very passive a lot of times in our protests lately. We're not as strong as some of these brothers and sisters are. And even the one that I just did with Carlotta Bass, she was very strong activist. The black press doesn't pick up those actions like it used to. And so what is that going to say for us? What example is it that we can take from the Paul Robesons, the Carlotta Basses, and those, and move that forward? So I'm going to open up with that discussion, give our audience a chance to make some comments. I want to ask, I think this is Brother Herbie White. I missed you last week, Brother White. I was trying to call you, get your opinion on some things, and somebody else that wasn't hear you. Is that you, Brother White? Are you on?
Yes, I'm on, Brother.
Okay,
Rogers, good. How you doing this week?
Fine, doing great. Thank you so much. We lost a lot of brothers in Durham this week, didn't we?
Yeah,
a lot of brothers we lost. But anyway, tell us what your impression of the great Paul Robeson was.
Well, I don't know a lot about Paul Robeson in detail.
Right.
I know about his activism. I know about how he was, you know, treated, and because it wasn't because of no communism or anything like that. It was the same old thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know a lot of, like, details that I could tell you that I know that this happened to him or that happened to him, or what his position was on a lot of things on, because there's not a lot of information.
That's right. That's right. And he was silenced. He was censored. And that censorship did not wear down until later. And a lot of folks now, historians, now are beginning to unveil a lot of things. There are a lot of books now available on life and times of Paul Robeson and what he did. And I think that very clearly, you know, it's worth us beginning to look at. That's my argument for Saturday schools. We can do that. We can get to our children and work with them in that way. Yep, you're right. Did you ever hear that story about the one where he came to Central?
No, this is the first I'm hearing about this.
Yeah, he came and walked out on the stage, and, you know, because segregation at the time. And even North Carolina Central, B and Duke Auditorium, was segregated when white folks came. They get the chance to sit in the front. Blacks had to sit in the balcony in a black college. And he said, no, I'm not singing here. And he walked off. And
I pass up and down Fayetteville Street all the time and pass that B and Duke Auditorium.
Right. Yeah, that's right. B and Duke, that's that philanthropy money from the Duke family.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, let me go over here to Brother Timothy. Brother Timothy, he did a lot of stuff in terms of, you know, Philadelphia. He had a very rich history in Philadelphia, a long history. And there's a lot of material about his relationship in Philadelphia. You want to tell us a little bit about anything you know about?
Well, let me tell you something, sir, that when my mother was an undergraduate, I was in ninth grade. It was in a senior year, and I was in ninth grade. She started teaching when I was in 10th grade.
Okay.
So, you know, she's on the Asante at Temple University. That's the richness of being able to have an advisor who was teaching Afro-American studies that early. People have to realize what he did in Philadelphia.
Right.
So she said, Tim, I'm going to do a paper on Paul Robeson. And I said, I never heard of the guy. You know what she told me?
What's that?
Her house right now today is on 51st Street between Spruce and Locust. She said, Tim, he lives around the corner. She said, when you walk down, you come from Irving Street, and you make a right angle, and you make another right angle, and you go to Westfield High School, I graduated from. She said, he lives on the corner of 50th and Walnut. I said, I never heard of the man. She said, he's famous, and he's something that most people stay away from. He was a socialist, a communist. So she said, guess what? People were spooked with him. So let me finish telling you the story. So time went on, and he died approximately when I was in 11th grade, at least 2 years.
Right.
So when he died, people gathered all around that house. And I told my mom, I said, you know what? And she's teaching now in high school by then. And I said, you know what? You were so right about it. I have all these people around. She said, Tim, she said, she showed me films of Emperor Jones. She, wait a minute, I read Othello in high school. All these things I did. And I said to my mom, I said, you know what? Why isn't that you and I never knocked on the door? She said, Tim, I wish we would have. She said, he probably would have never came down. She said, because she said she believed that he was poisoned by the government. Mm. But she said, I think his mind was, he stayed with his sister. And that house right now is a museum. It's right around the corner from the
That's right.
House.
It's right. It still exists, and, right? Right? And I saw a picture. I've seen a picture of it. It still exists, right?
That's right. It's still okay. There. It's a museum now. Okay. And I've been in there and studied with a bunch of socialists. Now, let me give you an example, right? So what I do is, here now, I come to Lincoln University. If anybody want to know about the Robinsons, the Mozells, and the Tanner, you got to read Horace Mann Bond, who was the president of Lincoln University.
Okay.
You talk about North Carolina. I could see Robeson doing that day. You know why? His father escaped from North Carolina and fought in the Civil War and graduated from Lincoln.
Right.
And guess what? The thing was that he met his wife, Maria Bastille, and it's a story about her. She's a black Quaker.
Yes,
and interesting, because you and I talk about the Quaker. Right. And let me finish telling you the story, right? And the aunt Gertrude also graduated from Lincoln. Now, there was a problem in marriage. I said, because he was a strong-looking black man, like a son, but if you could see, she was a mulatto, straight hair, and sort of like him. You know they disagreed with the marriage.
Right.
They looked down on him because he was a slave. That's deep.
Yeah.
It gets deeper than that. It gets deeper than that because Robeson, of course, went to Rutgers undergrad. When I study in Rutgers stats in South, you know, they South Jersey, Rutgers in South Jersey and North Jersey. I said, y'all got no pictures of Paul Robeson? White people said, who? I don't know about him now. And that was in the early 90s. But in any event, he was an All-American football player. Stood up, let me tell you, he was so strong. I'll tell you how strong he was. They broke his nose. He couldn't do nothing with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you can imagine football around the white people. Now, let me tell you, he was so good that he came and coached Lincoln University's football team in 1919 after he graduated from Rutgers.
Okay.
He coached Lincoln University's football team in 1919, and then he went to University of Columbia.
Yeah.
And after that, graduated from law school, and he pursued an acting career. Now, there is a special stacks at Temple University called the Bloxon Collection. If you want to know anything on Paul Robeson, Mr. Bloxon, try to catch him before he dies, could tell you anything you want to know about Paul Robeson.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, man, listen to me. There was one man that Malcolm X respected, and that was Paul Robeson.
Right.
And like I said, the history of Lincoln, they talk about this because the Bastilles, the Tanners, and the Robesons are all related. And they were the talented 10th of Philadelphia.
Right.
They were here. And it also, his mother taught at a school called Vaux in North Philadelphia.
All right.
So when you talk about Paul Robeson.
Yeah, he has a rich history.
And I go back to my high school years. I just wish. Huh?
We've got another person here from Philadelphia. I want to ask them. I don't know if they want to say something or they're just listening. Area code 610. You want to add anything to this conversation, listener, or are you just listening? Just a minute. Give this a minute, a sec. Okay, yeah, now. Area code 610. Okay, I guess they are just listening. But yeah, that history of Philadelphia is extremely rich, and you know, one of the reasons that a lot of the censorship, as you know, one of the things that the system does, the government system does, one of the things that they do is that they'll get other blacks to talk against you. And one of the things that they did was to get Jackie Robinson and Roy Wilkins to denounce Paul Robeson. And once they did that, that really put him on the blackball list. And like I said, he couldn't get concerts anymore. And obviously you heard his pocketbook. And that really created some other problems. Let me go over here. Area code 919-477. Any remarks? Caller? 919-477. Okay. Just listening. All right. What about 919-956?
Hotep, my brother.
Oh, my goodness. blast from the past. How you doing?
Yeah, but I'm blast from the past, but I'm an oldie goldie, though.
That's
I'm an
right.
oldie goldie.
That's right. How you doing? I'm so glad you called, my brother. I know, as I told Brother Herbie White, we lost some pioneers in Durham this week, I'm so sorry about that, you know. But anyway.
That 472, by the way, Bill, was another caller who you know, and I told her about the show, so she's listening, but she just wanted to listen.
Right, right.
But that was at 477.
Yeah.
And to those who may not know me, this is Bruce Bridges I'm calling in.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
I haven't called in a while, but what pioneers did we lose? You got another caller too from California. I called some other people.
Yep.
You know how I always do, yep, man.
Yeah, he's on. That's right. That's right. We lost.
You see a 626 number come up?
Yep, I sure did.
He's still there?
Let's see. No, I don't. No, we left. But
okay, because he wants to make some comments. He's an athlete from Hillside, and I told him to call in because he wanted to make some comments. Come from
if he comes back on, I definitely want to. I'm going to open it. So why don't you go on? You know, I know you've got a wealth of knowledge about the great Paul Robeson. What's some things that stick out in your mind, Brother Bruce?
Okay. Well, just before we go, who was the pioneers you say we lost in Durham?
Oh, we lost Brother Leon Cole. As you know, he was
that's right
master organist. I think his funeral is tomorrow.
Right.
And we lost Henry Gunn, Brother Henry Gunn. His,
I didn't know. You know, but that's right. They're from the West End.
Yes. No, Brookstown. Yeah, he was in Brookstown.
I mean, yeah, I called the West End. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I know.
You're
right.
Right.
Right. Yep, we lost both of them. You know, really, really good brothers. They were all in their 70s, you know, had done some wonderful work in Durham, you know, great things. Matter of fact, I think Brother Gunn's son recently ran for Durham City Council.
That's right. That's right. You're right. You're absolutely
Joshua
right.
Joshua Gunn, yeah.
And speaking of Durham City Council, too, I know you had to have heard all this going on over in the housing project.
Oh,
Durham
yeah. Yeah, Michael was telling me that. Yeah, he did. He told me about the MacDougal Terrace problem. Yeah, that's
right.
Really a problem.
Yeah. It actually is MacDougal Terrace, Hoover Road, Oxford Manor, and just Durham Housing Authority in general, but particularly it is MacDougal Terrace. But when I heard you talking about Paul Robeson, I got to call in.
Yeah,
I don't
please,
know how far you've gone
please.
Back into him. I heard the brother from Philadelphia talking about him, but did they talk about our homeboy roots, Bill?
Who is that?
Paul Robeson, have y'all talked about our home brother roots?
Oh, yeah. You know, did you hear that story about him when he came to NCCU and walked out on the stage and it was segregated? Did you ever hear that story?
No, tell that story before I go into it, because I'm going to be with you. So go ahead. What happened?
Well, I think this probably was the late 40s or the early 50s, like 1950, because I was a kid, and my parents had gone to hear him. He was performing at BN Duke Auditorium, and he walked out to begin his performance. They opened the curtains, and he looked into the audience, and he asked the question. He leaned over the other side and asked the question, Is this? Did you say this was North Carolina College for Negroes? And the person said, yeah. He said, well, why? It's, whites are sitting down front and the Negroes sitting up in the balcony. And and he said, no, I'm not singing here. And he walked back off.
I hadn't heard that one,
yeah,
Bill.
Yeah, that's a rich story. That was coming from an eyewitness who was there.
And, okay, yeah, I believe you. I just hadn't heard that one. And when I mentioned our home brother roots, I was talking about the fact that Paul Robeson had roots in North Carolina. Had you probably already mentioned that, right?
Right. No, we didn't get in detail. Why don't you share that with us, please?
Okay, good. That's what I really wanted to do.
Okay.
And as we go on, I want to thank your brother Herbie White too for calling me and telling me what the topic was tonight.
Oh, great!
So I said,
yeah.
Let me get back on it because I don't have class tonight. But I just want to let you know that Paul Robeson, not just you, and it's a little known fact. I really think, Bill, that Paul Robeson roots are from North Carolina, the state of North Carolina.
Right.
And he talked. He in his book. Here I Stand, which you may have mentioned because I heard you mention some of the book.
Right.
But his book, which is really his autobiography, Here I Stand. He talks about, and I even heard him in his own voice on Pacifica Radio, a tape of a radio program he did back in the early 70s on Pacifica Radio in California. And he himself says that I'm quoting Paul Rosen, he says, I have roots in the state of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Then the interviewer asked the question, where? Then he goes into the fact that he is his father was from Robesonville, North Carolina, and his father's name is from the last name, and so therefore that's what Paul gets his name. Their name is from the biggest slave owner in eastern North Carolina, whose last name was Robeson.
Yeah,
so they
yeah.
named the town Robesonville, and the father was on that Mr. Robeson's plantation. Now, to those who are listening in North Carolina also, I'm giving a little North Carolina history here, Bill, if you don't mind.
No, that's good. No, that's good. Go right ahead.
All right. Now, to those who may know a little bit about North Carolina, and I used to get it mixed up myself until I got, as they say, I got the straight of it. There's a town, as you well know, Bill, down near Lumberton, where the so-called Lumbee Indians are from, called Robeson, North Carolina. That's a town, Robeson.
Right. That's right.
Right. But Robesonville is a county. In eastern North Carolina is a town, eastern North Carolina.
Yeah, Robeson County. Yeah, right. That's right.
Well, that's where Paul Robeson's father was from. And his father ran away from a plantation there and ended up in Princeton, New Jersey, because I'm sure you talked about that. But he grew up in Princeton, but his father was really from down in eastern North Carolina. And I used to drive through there myself sometimes, going back again,
right.
Bill, to a little North Carolina history. When you leave Durham, North Carolina, where I'm from, going east in the state of North Carolina, I was headed to Elizabeth City, and you go down through Highway 17, and Highway 17 goes right smack dab through Robeson County, North Carolina, and that's where the town of Robesonville is. You go right through it on the way to Elizabeth City, and I was headed to Elizabeth City to a black college there called Elizabeth City State University, and you know that.
Right,
but I'm saying that
exactly.
For our listeners who are tuned
right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Right, and so his roots are North Carolina, and a lot of people don't know it, and it's a little known fact. And that reminds me, this is why it's very important when we understand, as you know, Bill, the roots
from?
Of history, because Paul Robeson, in some of his speeches I've read, he always talks about the tobacco workers down in eastern North Carolina and how he says he allies himself with the workers. And when he used to speak as a member of the Communist Party, he spoke for the working class people.
Right.
He spoke for the proletariat
right.
as opposed to speaking for the bourgeoisie.
That's right.
The two parties under the communist system, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie.
Right.
He spoke for the proletariat,
right.
You see, and which also reminds when we talk about these little towns where people are from. Now, even though this is not your subject, but I want to just kind of tie it in. When we look at Stedman Graham, Stedman Graham was from also a town in New Jersey, not too far from Princeton, called Whitesboro, New Jersey. That's where Stedman. But But Stedman has roots, as you well know, down in Columbus County, North Carolina, and is a Spaulding from there. But his father left North Carolina under some very similar conditions for a better life and to get away from some of the racism in North Carolina. And he moved up to Whitesboro, New Jersey, which was a town founded by Paul Laurence Dunbar, Booker T. Washington, and George White. A black politician from North Carolina. They founded that town of Whitesboro. Right. And that's where Stedman left North Carolina and went up there, which is another topic because George White and Booker T. Washington and Dunbar founded that town because black folk were being run out of North Carolina after the Wilmington race riots of 1898. So I didn't want to go into all that, but I'm just trying to
tell you. No, this is good. This is good. Because this is why I wanted to talk about Robeson, because it's so overreaching. There's a lot of areas that this embraces, and, you know, his whole work with labor. Right.
And this is why I called my friend, like I told you, who was an athlete at Hillside, who played on that team that they had in about 67, undefeated team in 1967,
right,
where people they scored over 100 points per game, because he and I were talking earlier about politics, and like you said, there's so much to Robeson, the roots that we're talking about. And allied to working class people, and also he's not just being an athlete, but he was an activist.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I asked somebody the other day about Kobe Bryant, because upon his death, I wanted to mention that. But I asked him, I say, has Kobe, as far as you all know, and I'm not saying he has or has not, because I don't know a lot about him, I know a little bit, but as a matter of fact, I asked Herbie White, did he ever make a stand? Uh-huh. Or take a stand, you know, but Paul Robeson was an athlete, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, as we well know, and Jim Brown, as we well know, and Bill Russell, as we well know, and Mahmoud Muhammad, the basketball player, as we well know, and Colin Kaepernick, as we well know, and probably some others that I'm not mentioning, but there's not a whole lot of them, and of course Muhammad Ali, and Carlos and Smith. But there are athletes who will take a stand for what is right and just in society, and Paul Robeson was indeed one of those kinds of people who took a stand against, and you see what happened to him too. You say he was blackballed, but I like to say whiteballed. He was whiteballed. he was whiteballed for taking the stand.
He sure was.
That he took. He was whiteballed, you know, for taking the stand that he took. And I always thought, and then, you know, when Paul Robeson played football, when you read his biography and his autobiography, he talks about the fact that the football players would try to
hurt him.
His hands with their cleats,
to the
ground.
That's
and how sure when did. He played for the Scarlet Knights of Princeton's football team, they have a game against a team in the South. And because he was a black man on a northern white team, the team in the South that Princeton was playing against refused to come out and play the game because the black man was on the team.
Yes, that's right.
You know, I'm just trying to show you, you know, what Robeson went through.
And that's why it's so surprising that Jackie Robinson would have done
against him,
what he did. You know,
I heard you mention that again in the court process. That's right. He came against Paul Robeson because he had been through the same thing.
He had been through the same thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So really, and I didn't want to just take the show.
No. This is good. I'm glad I know you wrote a book. And you've included some of this kind of information in there. It was very vital.
This is what we need to get
out of this discussion. This was an activist. You're going to always be chastised for your activism.
Hey, I'm sitting here right now, Bill, I'm somewhat of a victim of that myself, and I'm going to let you know something that you probably don't know. But in Durham, they had something called the 150th anniversary a couple of months ago, and they've been honoring people in Durham. And in other words, when all these kinds of things are done, Bill, they never, ever say anything about me.
And
I didn't
you
take
did
the
with
bourgeois
your bookstore.
Stand.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and but there are certain people that they want to project in front of our community as being successful, but when you take a stand and speak out for your people against the powers that be, against capitalism, against sexism, against racism, against anything anti people of color, they chastise you
they
for
chastise.
It.
That's right.
I mean, I know that
because really, as brilliant as W.E.B. Du Bois was, you know, if he would have been a Caucasian man, he would have been right up there with Ralph Waldo Emerson and all of those other big high-top intellectuals, because he was, in a lot of cases, he was shopping him. But because of what
he was.
Yeah. And what he spoke out against, he lived a terrible life. And he struggled under some heavy kind of a chastisement from the white power. You remember, I don't know if you remember the story where he tried to write for, what is that, the prestigious Academy of Arts. That's that organization of all the big intellectuals.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he had tried, and they wouldn't accept his work. And he ended up starting the Negro Academy of Arts. You know, so he could put
That's right. He started the Negro Academy. And since you mentioned the arts, too, and we're talking about music, what's the brother's name that passed a couple? Oh, one of the Heath brothers.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy Heath, wasn't it? Was it Jimmy?
There you go. You're a jazz man, the jazz musician. And the reason I wanted to mention Jimmy Heath, because Jimmy Heath had some family down in Wilmington, North Carolina.
That's right.
Also.
I saw that. I didn't know he was from North Carolina. I saw it in his obituary thing.
Right.
Yep.
And since you mentioned Jimmy Heath too, and you mentioned Du Bois, there was a man, I know what it was. The keyboard player, Wayne Shorter.
Oh yeah.
Who actually wrote Taking the A Train for Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington gets most of the credit. But Wayne Shorter also lived in North Carolina, Bill, over in Hillsboro, North Carolina. A lot of people don't know
that. I didn't know Wayne Shorter was from Hillsboro.
He had a grandmother lived there. He used to come down here to stay with his grandmother.
Okay.
Yeah,
and even Nina Simone. I didn't know until much later that Nina Simone's background was
North Carolina.
Yeah.
Right. They brought a lot of tough slaves down here to this plantation in North Carolina.
Yeah, they sure
man.
Did, man. That's that tobacco. That tobacco plantation. You're right.
But what I was going to say about Wayne Shorter and you mentioned the Academy of Negro, Langston Hughes and other people who were involved in the somewhat bourgeois elitist Harlem Renaissance, as you well know, to tell it like it is. That's what it really was.
Right.
Not that it wasn't good. So, you know, we know about the poetry and art, drama and all that came out of it. But Zora Neale Hurston and all that. But Langston Hughes used to date the piano player who wrote Taking the Eight Train.
Yeah, I know. Jimmy, not his, Strayhorn.
There you go, Billy.
Yeah, right. That's exactly
Billy Strayhorn. That's who I met from North Carolina. Billy Strayhorn.
Yeah.
I think I might say Wayne Shorter, didn't I?
Yeah, you did say Wayne Shorter.
Okay, thank you. Billy Strayhorn.
Okay.
Hillsboro, North Carolina.
Yeah, he was in love with Langston Hughes. Yeah, he was in love with him, man. Yeah, you're right.
He was in love with Billy Strayhorn. As a matter of fact, since we're talking about Paul Robeson, Paul Robeson is really like a diamond. And it's another book I just read, too. I want to talk about it one night on your show about diamonds in South Africa.
Okay.
But anyway, Paul Robeson, like a diamond, has many facets.
Right.
And so now in terms of his art, but Langston Hughes dated Billy Strayhorn, and the great Lena Horne was in love with Billy Strayhorn.
Right.
But she did not marry him because of his inclination towards the same sex.
Exactly. And then you know, Billy Strayhorn really was in love with Duke Ellington. And Duke,
that's exactly right.
And Duke didn't go that way. Duke said no.
So Paul Robeson has we can talk about him as an artist, an athlete, an intellectual. So, you know, I'm, and I know you got some other people probably want to make some comments, but I'm going to stay with you. I'm still with you.
Oh, please do that. I'm going to go over here to Brother Pugh, and then I'm going to go to Sister Benicia, where she's on. James.
You got the brother from California, don't you? 6'2".
No, he didn't come back on yet. I'm hoping he will. Maybe you give him a little sidebar call.
Matter of fact, I'm going to put my phone on mute. I'm going to get on my cell phone and call him back.
Please do that. I'll grab him right away.
It'll be good to hear from Sister Benicia while, too. I haven't heard about
her
in a while.
Yeah, she's on here. I'll get her in a minute. I'm going to get her in just a minute. Brother,
all right, peace. I'm still with you.
Okay. Brother Pugh, what you think?
Well, actually, I'm really learning quite a bit. I know very little about Paul Robeson, and I'm... You know, was kind of interested to ask Dr. Bridges a question about when the transition happened in terms of when he began to be rehabilitated and from the kind of black or white balling, as he called it. But
it didn't. He went all the way up into the 70s. even during the civil rights years. They did, the Supreme Court gave him their pass, gave him his passport, him and his wife his passport back. And at that point, it allowed him to go out of the country and do some singing and do some things. But he still never got that popularity here in the country like it was, you know. And from what I gather, the black press balled him, too. Black, or like Brother Bridges said, white balled him as well. They would not support a lot of the things he was because, you know, they made it, the communist was, any affiliation with Communist Party was a no-no. But it was interesting when Jackie Robinson's deathbed, he confessed that that was a mistake for him to do that because for him to have chastised Paul Robeson because Paul Robeson very clearly was, you know, he suffered the same things that he suffered, and he should not have gone against him in the way that he did. But that really didn't. And let me ask you: in your years in school, did you were you ever introduced to him in your grade school years, Brother Pugh?
No, never in grade school, and no, I've never actually been exposed.
Yeah, that's
to,
it. Most of us have
Paul
not.
Robeson,
did not,
other than you know,
did not get Paul Robeson.
Own, yeah,
yeah mm-hmm. You're right. You're right. Okay, mm-hmm. Sister Benicia, how you doing?
Yes, good evening. I'm okay. How are you doing?
Doing wonderful. Doing great. Got your buddy on the other end.
I know. I see he got you all stirred up and stimulated intellectually.
Yeah. Right.
Good
to hear from you.
People think he's Bruce.
Brother Bridges, you still on? You there?
I'm still here. I was just talking. Peace. Hotep, my dear sister. Hotep.
Hotep, how are you?
All right, I didn't know we were set up so where you could hear, he could hear both of us at the same time. I'm doing better now. I'll talk to you about it later, but I've been a little under the weather, but you probably couldn't hope you couldn't tell in my voice because I'm trying to get back.
All right. No, you sound good. You sound great. You sound great. And the brother from
California. Keep on healing and let's definitely talk in the future. I don't know if you knew Larry, and I was going to mention this in what I share. Larry Darnell that owned Africa and More.
Where's African Moore located?
It was on Gay City Boulevard. You remember Baluba's?
Oh, yeah.
So he's the brother that used to manage Baluba's.
Okay, I know who you're talking about. I do. It's been a long time, from way back.
Well, he just recently transitioned.
Oh, please, don't even talk about it.
Recently transitioned. He had gotten his own store, and he sold everything African. He practiced Ujamaa. I mean, the brother was a quiet soldier. I wanted to share that, Dr. Rogers, when you were talking about the different ones that transitioned in Durham, and I want to share about Larry Darnell because he was just an amazing brother.
And
a lot of young people into their own businesses, and he gave people credit at wholesale prices. He wasn't greedy.
Wow.
He was literally practicing Ujamaa.
Beautiful.
And just, I'm going to let you go ahead and talk, Sister Benice, with Brother William. I'm going to go ahead and hang up and call you on my cell phone because this phone's about to die. So just letting you know, I'll be back on. Y'all go ahead.
Okay. Sister Benice, the fact that you went to the East, which was an African-centered school, did they teach about Paul Robeson?
Well, that was so long ago.
Okay.
I don't even remember because that was many years ago.
Okay.
But the East was an educational and cultural center for African people.
Right.
And Uhuru Sasa Shule was the school that I attended.
Well, I'm probably sure that they probably said something about Paul Robeson. I'm pretty sure.
It's possible, but like I said, it was so long ago. I was a teenager. And
okay.
So, you know, I just don't remember a lot. But I will say that throughout my education, the few Black History courses that I took, he wasn't one that was, you know, weren't much teaching about him. I may have seen a documentary, a video or something about him over the years. But not too much.
Okay.
Not too much.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I just want to share briefly, and I always say this, but I do want to share briefly that, so first and foremost, like Brother Pugh, I'm getting a history lesson. I'm learning.
Okay.
You know, great. Whenever you and Bruce get together, I go into student mode.
Yep.
But I as I listen to these conversations about the great black folk, the great Africans that were here, all the things we did and all the doors we'd break through and run into Europe or, you know, some part of Europe and feeling like we're free there when, you know, the people that might have been living there weren't free. But right. If you're a celebrity, they treat you like you're free, you know, in parts of Europe. So I wanted to throw that out. But, yeah, just to hear about how brilliant we are and what we've all the hell we've gone through, I just keep wondering and thinking that it wasn't worth it. I'm not wondering. I'm just thinking that it just wasn't worth it. But I wonder if we had taken all of our talent and our creativity and our power and used it to maintain a separate black nation and to build a separate black nation, I wonder if we would have been successful in that.
Okay, yeah.
Because they really did not want us, and the only reason that whites accepted us with a whole lot of, with a good dose, a huge dose of brutality and savageness was because of our ability to entertain.
Well, you know, think about Garvey, you know, what Garvey was trying to do in creating a separate
yes.
black nation. He his problem was traitors, people from within. And
that's always it. But let's say if there were lots of Garveys, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If most of us were about building a black nation, and I'm saying this because of all the talent and all the power that we do have, as we learn about our history, if we would have put that energy into building for ourselves and not having to go through all the hell
right.
that we went through. You know, I was listening to Martin Luther King, and he talked about how humiliating, and I hadn't heard that word, I hadn't heard him talk about that before, how humiliating it was to be a black man in America. You know?
Yeah.
And so yeah, I think about that. If we could have, you know, bypassed all of that hell and put our energy into building for ourselves and what that could have looked like.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm thinking about.
Right.
And I'm still in student mode.
Okay. All right. We got our brother on from Pasadena, California. Nice sunny California. How you doing, my brother?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. Nice to talk with you. Yeah, I just talked a little earlier to Brother Bruce Bridges, and
yes.
He informed me about your radio show.
Right.
So
thank you so much.
We had talked earlier, and I said I would call in and speak with you.
Yeah, please do. What's your take on Paul Robeson?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that. You know, you hear about him because we never got taught about that in our school.
That's right. That's right.
We never had black history in our school. So what we picked up on our own. We either got it through a book or we saw it on television.
Right.
And people had construed what this man was about.
Yes.
Now, he was not a communist.
No, he wasn't. Not at all.
Okay. Now, what people have to realize that whenever black people decide to go against what they are doing bad to us, they're going to put a bad connotation on it. They're going to call you a communist, a radical,
right.
or a militant, because they think you're supposed to take what they're doing to you and accept it.
Right.
Mm. So Paul Robeson didn't do that.
No, he didn't.
Now, he went where he was accepted. Even if he went to Russia and they treated him like a man, why wouldn't I go?
Right.
You know, and don't mean that I have to adopt the way they think. But when he went there, they accepted him like he was a great man over there. When he come back to the United States, oh, man, they had a lynch rope waiting for him.
Right, right.
He couldn't go any place he wanted to go.
No,
you know, people come in and they give him flowers and listen to him speak and give him standing ovations. When you come back here There's nothing like that going on.
Right. That's exactly right.
So this man was just an intellect. He was a great singer. He was a great actor.
Yes, he was.
So a lot of times when we do Black History Month, we don't think of this guy. We know that the ones that they want us to think about all the time basically would be Dr. Martin Luther King, which is nothing
right.
wrong with that because I grew up in that era.
Right. Right.
Okay, I was born and raised in Durham, North Carolina, in Jim Crow.
Okay. Did you go to Hillside?
I grew up in there. Went to Hillside High School.
Okay, all right.
Coach Russell Blunt.
Oh, yeah.
Coach Carl L. Eastland was my basketball coach.
The Bear.
Coach Willie Bradshaw.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I played basketball there. And I played on a what I call myself is a sports activist, brother.
Yeah.
Because I played on a basketball team at Hillside High called, we were nicknamed the Pony Express. I don't know if you ever heard of us.
Sounds familiar.
In 1966, yeah, we averaged 108 points a ball game during the regular season with no 3-point shot, no shot clock, no overtime games, right?
Right.
By the time we played our 5 championship games, we ended up averaging 105.
Hmm.
But we never got any credit for it at all.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I decided to do, I wrote 2 books about it. The first book I wrote was called 32 Minutes of Greatness, The Untold Story.
Give me the title once more.
32 Minutes of Greatness, The Untold Story. That was the first one.
Okay.
The second one was 32 Minutes of Greatness, Special Edition.
Mm.
Okay, now when I wrote those books, nobody was talking about us, okay? Saying anything about what we had done because they buried us deep. You know, like put you on the back burner of irrelevance because
right.
we were black.
Right.
We were an all-black school.
Right.
So if I put in my book, if it had been Durham High School, the all-white
school. Oh, yeah. They would have played that.
Oh, man, you know, they would have had parades. They never would have forgotten it.
Yep, that's right.
Would have gone to visit the president or everything else, but we got nothing. Okay? So I wrote these 2 books. And what was so interesting about it, brother, I was listening to ESPN and watching it one day, and this guy was talking about Loyola Marymount.
Uh-huh.
You know, with Hank Gappers and Bo, you know, and they were talking about how many points they had scored a game.
Right.
And I called in and told the guy, well, we did that in 1966. And the man said, no, you didn't. No high school team can do that. I said, yes, we did. I think that was about 38 years. Our records were about 38 years old. And he said, no, that can never happen.
Ooh.
So I said, let me send you a book, a copy of my book.
Okay.
I sent it. I said, now you read it, do some research, and get back to me. Okay, now he did that, but the phone call came in with a producer named Weezy Shapiro. I'll never forget it. And we started talking because, you know, Charlie Scott was involved in it.
Okay.
Earl the Goat Manigault. They called
okay.
the greatest playground basketball
That's
player
right.
that ever lived.
Yep, I remember. I've seen that documentary on him. Yep.
Yeah, John Lucas Jr. was our ball boy.
Okay.
Henry Bibby, the late Herman Gilliam. You know, all those people were involved. But when I wrote that book, it started a chain reaction in Durham. And around the country, and especially out here in California.
Right.
When I wrote that book, man, they went crazy out here. They didn't know. They said, nobody could ever do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's what we did. So when black people, I heard the young lady saying about what if we had gotten together and do our own thing sometime.
Right. That's what we got to do.
Yeah, and this is what can happen.
Yeah, we got to write our own story. Yeah.
There you go. You got that right. When we take our own history into our own hands, then we can get somewhere with it.
That's right.
So now when this history is being discussed now, It's our history now. They can't write nothing to change what I wrote because
That's
I was
right.
there.
Right. That's right.
I was on that team.
So you saw
right?
it. You knew. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was right there. So, and now, you know, by them not knowing about us, like they not knowing about Paul Robeson.
Right.
We all get into the same boat sometimes because they give us what they want us to have.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and like
powerful.
I said, I don't have anything against Martin Luther King because, you know, I was out there marching too.
Right.
You know, I got kicked out of restaurants.
Right.
You know, I got beat up in a grocery store up in Baltimore.
Yeah.
When I was in the eighth grade.
And that's considered
you know,
the norm.
Just waiting for a friend
right.
of mine.
Yep.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I'm a black kid standing there waiting for my father's friend. He was keeping me that day. And they wanted to know what I was doing. And they started calling me the N-word.
Yeah.
Or you're here to steal something. Oh, and they roughed me up, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking all the time. Now, suppose they call the police on me. I'm up here in Baltimore. I'm just a kid.
Right.
And they put me in that system. They'll never find me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
You know. Those are the kind of things that we had to go through.
Well, that's why we got to tell this story.
I could not tell this black man that came to pick me up what they had done to me because you can't get in a white man's face back in those days.
Better not. Yeah. Better not.
That's right. You couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate this, my brother. I really do. Thank you so much for coming on. Please stay on for a little bit. We got a few more minutes. We got about a half hour to go. And I definitely want to go over here to my brother Marcus from
yes
sir, brother Marcus. Have you ever heard of Paul Robeson before? Modern Times.
Yes, yes, yeah. I heard of
okay.
I heard of Paul Robeson, but that was late. You hear me?
Yeah, yeah. You said it was in the later period. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I heard about him real late and stuff like that, and I'm learning now more
right.
from you, but I see a lot of parallels to, you know, what happened now to people who take the stand. Same like Paul Robeson, like as the brother was saying about Kaepernick, even Bill Cosby.
Right.
You see what they did to him, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, Bill Cosby had those shows, A Different World and stuff, and they said that during that time, that black folk, especially the black men, enrollment in college increased.
Right, exactly.
You know what? That's a section of white folk.
Yeah.
That's what white folk do. You know what I'm saying? So sometimes when we get surprised, oh, look what they did. That's what they do.
Right. That's okay? The way they do. That's right.
What, and they got their flunkies that they send out. Well, we're supposed to have something in there to knock the flunky in the hand. Okay, let the flunky know, look, there is no benefit in being a flunky junkie. All right? So we got to start to serve these flunkies, man. Because
yeah.
The flunky is the one that's running the show.
Right.
We
yeah.
got to clean house, brother.
Yeah.
We got to get serious and start to clean house.
Yes, we do.
You know,
yes,
but
we do.
I appreciate what you are doing here because I'm learning so much.
That's yeah, well, I appreciate it, Brother Marcus.
Much.
Always appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
We've got a caller at area code 586 out of Michigan. Caller, did you want to say something or are you just listening?
Yes, sir, I would like to say something.
Oh, please, thank you. Go right ahead.
Okay. So that I don't lose focus, I'm just going to list some subjects that I would like to talk about just briefly about Brother Paul Robeson.
Okay, please.
First of all, I was well into my adulthood, approaching senior citizen status before I really got an understanding of who Paul Robeson was.
Wow.
Let me tell you something.
Uh-huh.
I was mad about it. All this time, nobody had told me about Paul Robeson.
Right.
And then when I started learning about him and self-educating myself about him, I just fell head over heels in love with the man.
Yes.
For real, for real. Now, let me say this. Recently, I got a copy of the thesis that Paul Robeson, at age 21, wrote when he was at Rutgers University.
Okay.
It was submitted May 29, 1919. The title of his thesis was, quote, "The Fourth Amendment, the sleeping giant of the American Constitution, end quote.
Wow.
The brother, 21 years old, and that's where his mind was back then.
Oh,
now, in 1951, Paul Robeson, along with William Patterson, they went to the United Nations and presented that petition called We Charge Genocide.
Yeah.
If you read that petition today, you'd think that they wrote it last week, unfortunately. It cited many instances and reasons that the United Nations should step in on behalf of the quote-unquote Negroes of the USA, because according to genocide, as it was defined by the United Nations back in the day, what was happening to the quote-unquote Negroes, blacks in the United States, we certainly met that definition.
Right. Wow.
The other thing I'd like to speak to is a book written by Marie Seton, S-E-T-O-N,
okay.
Marie Seton.
Marie Seton, okay.
That was written in 1958. Now, she wrote about Paul Robeson from the perspective of an English woman. Now, you know, Paul and his wife lived in England for about 12 years.
Right.
They lived abroad. And and she wrote a very interesting book, one that is well worth reading, too. It's called Paul Robeson, with a foreword by Sir Arthur Bryant.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that particular book, she talks about how Paul Robeson was not a communist. What I mean by that is she cites the date in the committee where Paul Robeson said under oath that he was not a communist.
Right.
Now, mind you, he said, quote, I label myself as a very violently anti-fascist, end quote. This was what Paul Robeson said when, in response to a question, are you a communist?
Because, right.
You know, they took him down to a degree, ruined his finances, all saying that he was a communist.
Sure did.
Mind you, he had a lot of communist friends. He supported, you know, some of the, like Ben Davis in New York. He had friends who were part of the Communist Party, but he himself never self-identified as such.
Right.
He identified as being very violently anti-fascist.
Right.
Now, now that was in 1946, the so-called Tenney Committee.
Yeah.
It was the 7th California Legislative Committee on Un-American Activities.
Because, right.
You know, after he had told them no, he refused to answer the question anymore. From 1946 on, he refused to answer the question as to whether or not he was a communist. Okay, now that's one thing. And the other thing I wanted to mention was the meeting that almost happened between Paul Robeson and Malcolm X. Back in January 1965, at the funeral of Lorraine Hansberry.
Mm.
Now, mind you, I'm sourcing this from the book that Paul Robeson Jr. wrote.
Yeah, no, you're teaching me on this one. I didn't know he was had a chance to meet with Malcolm. That's interesting.
Yeah, Malcolm X had asked to meet with Paul Robeson. He approached Paul. Here's the deal. You can find this in The Undiscovered Paul Robeson,
wow.
Quest for Freedom, 1939 to 1976.
Right.
This is written by Paul Robeson Jr. in 2010. I know you quoted that you sourced that, but this was page 344 to 345. But what happened was, at Lorraine Hansberry's funeral, this was January 16, 1965, where Malcolm approached Paul Robeson Jr. And I'm going to just read the two quotes right here from right from the source. And this is Paul Robeson Jr. talking. He says, and I quote, it says, he asked to meet my father, speaking of Malcolm X. When I replied that I would try to arrange it on the spot, Malcolm put his hand gently on my arm. No, no, he said, we shouldn't meet here with the press all around. I'd like to arrange a private meeting where we can talk comfortably. I'm contemplating some things I'd like to discuss with your father, end quote, he said. And then Paul Robeson says here, Jr. says, I said I understood and would be right back. As I started to ask Paul about meeting with Malcolm, S.C. agitatedly proclaimed that she wouldn't allow Malcolm X to come into the reception room and would stand in the doorway if she had to. Before I could say anything, Paul peremptorily ordered her to be quiet. Turned to me and said, "Tell Malcolm that you will arrange for him to come and see me at Jumel Terrence." When I relayed Paul's message to Malcolm, he smiled, thanked me, and said that McDonald would be in touch with me soon. Alas, the meeting never took place. Over the following month, Malcolm was preoccupied with guaranteeing his family's survival. I hadn't heard yet from McDonald when Malcolm was assassinated on February 21 at the Audubon Ballroom, just a few blocks from the Jumel Terrace.
Right.
End of quote. Now, again, this is Paul Robeson Jr.,
right,
his exactly. book, mm-hmm. The Undiscovered. Yeah, now, mind you, we have a historian here in Michigan, Malcolm X expert to a degree, Paul Lee.
Oh.
And Paul Lee, he has a little different slant on what happened. He doesn't deny that, you know, this meeting that you know, Malcolm X requested a meeting with Paul Robeson, but it didn't happen. But well, that's a little another story. But I was surprised to find out. I was pleasantly surprised to find that in that book. And I don't know if SC's objection was. Well, I don't know what that was about. But
exactly,
those are some things I wanted to cover. The last thing,
and those are good.
The last
that's
thing,
good.
Doc, was the Council of African Affairs. Paul Robeson was very instrumental in. That organization,
okay.
Which
where was that? Was that out of Michigan? Where was that organization out of? You remember
what Michigan? What?
The Council of African American Affairs. Is that a was that a New York organization?
No, sir. No. The Council on African Affairs. This was something that Paul Robeson was the president of.
All right.
Yeah. When I mentioned, I forgive me if I don't mean to confuse things.
Uh-huh.
It's just that.
But you are.
Oh, well. What can I do to unconfuse it? What did I do? What can I do to unconfuse? Where's the confusion at?
Well, no. I'm just wondering. Where did he start that organization? Where did he operate that from? What city?
Paul Robeson?
Yes.
The Council on African Affairs?
Yes. I was wondering if that was one of his Philadelphia operations.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I just know that and a brother named W. Alpheus Hunton, he was the point person for that Council African Affairs. And he worked closely with Paul Robeson on that. Paul Robeson helped fund it.
Because, see, one of the interesting things just in what you're saying, which is, so powerful, there were a lot of attempts of individuals in those 40s, 30s, in that middle years to get together with each other, but they were afraid to do that. Dr. Bridges, you remember I said to you that there's some background history that Elijah Muhammad met with Asa Spaulding. Remember we talked about that?
Oh, I do.
Right. But it was a very, very quiet, hush-hush kind of meeting, and it was never promoted, obviously, at any point. But there was some information because, you know, these were two powerful, economically structured brothers, both of them, you know, North Carolina Mutual and obviously the Nation of Islam. And they may have been meeting to do business together. You know, we don't know, but it had to be hush-hush. But anyway, the brothers from the Nation.
Like a lot of things during that time had to be hush-hush when black people were beginning to organize and so-called radical groups such as Nation of Islam, along with a conservative Negro group in Durham, with Spaulding and, you know, the Durham group, they had to kind of keep it on the down low.
Right. You have to. Right. And it's a lot of it is the reason why we don't know about Paul Robeson, because in the fact they had to keep that quiet, you know. But I am sure, I can almost assure you that they all knew, and even Marcus Garvey, you know, Garvey had to, a lot of folks reached out to Garvey, but had to do it quietly, you know, and it had to be done behind closed doors. And one of the people that reached out, from what I understand from some information, is that somehow or the other, him and Du Bois did have some conversation about some things. Now, what it was, I don't know, you know. But that's interesting. That's why I was asking you, my sister from Michigan, about that.
Yes,
sir. Yeah, because that's interesting. Okay. How those coalitions had to operate very quietly behind mm-hmm. the scenes, and obviously we don't have that history, which we should have, you know. And I'm glad you shared with us some of that history you had, because I didn't know that.
Let me ask something else, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Is there anything else that I said that might have contributed to some confusion? I do not want to contribute to confusion.
I'm clear.
Is there something else I need to clear up here?
I'm clear. What about you, Brother Bruce? Anything that she said that you weren't?
Oh, no. She was pretty clear. But she did say something. She mentioned the name. Essie, I can't remember.
Essie is short for Islanda. That's Paul Robeson's wife. Islanda Robeson.
Right. Exactly.
That's what I thought. But see, I was just thinking. I knew that. But some people might not have known that when you said Essie came to the door and kept him, you know, right. But
yes, sir. Sure, right. Well, in that case, I was quoting directly from the book.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Agitatedly proclaimed. Yeah, I was still in the quote.
I got you. You were just saying exactly as Paul Robeson Jr. said it.
Yes, sir.
Right. And, you know, one reason I mentioned it, too, and I've learned this, Bill, and I think you have, too, and that's why I was saying to the sister, I usually, even if people already know something in terms of teaching and explaining to our people, especially with somebody like Paul Robeson, and as we both, all of us who listen have heard people say, who knew nothing about Paul Robeson. Oftentimes, you have to assume that people who might know, they might know, but assume that they don't know what you're talking about anyway, and then you won't miss anybody.
Right.
That's
exactly.
Why I said,
exactly.
Right. You just exactly. Assume, like you said, NC, I knew what you meant because I knew his wife's name. But see, and you knew it because you were reading the book, and that's what that son, Paul Robeson Jr., was, you know, that's who he's talking about, his mother.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Right. But see, most people know nothing at all about Paul Robeson, and much less his family. So in our teaching and explaining to our people about our history in terms of clarity and being concise, we have to assume that they know nothing. And those who already know it, no problem. They're just hearing it again.
Right. There's a great article that you might want to look at based on what my sister from Michigan was saying. It's in the Smithsonian Magazine called What Paul Robeson Said. It was written back in mm-hmm. September 13th, 2011. And it is online. It goes through the whole story of what happened and how they misquoted him in the paper. And as you said earlier, he did not say that he was a communist. And they misquoted him, and that's how a lot of that whiteballing, as you said, Brother Bridges, happened. It came out of that misquote of, as what your president said, fake news did that,
mm-hmm.
and how it,
right.
That chastised.
Yes, sir, and not only that, if I may add, the president of the Communist Party, I think it was Gus Hall, whatever,
yeah, Gus Hall,
claimed
right.
that Paul Robeson was a communist, but he claimed it after Paul Robeson was gone and could not defend himself.
Right. Exactly.
I found that a little disturbing.
Exactly.
That there are some people that just prefer to believe that the man was a communist, no
right.
matter the documentation to the contrary,
right.
in his own words.
Right, exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I saw yes, Brother sir. Lance on a little while ago, Sister Benicia. I don't know if he's – no, he's off. I think Sister Benicia was off, too. but anyway, you're right. Let me go with one other person that's been here, too, and let me see.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, sister, too.
Brother Pugh, you want to, and the reason I call on you is I know you always have great ideas about these kinds of things. Is there anything you want to add before you do? Hold on just a minute. This internet's acting up real ugly. Okay, now, Brother Pugh, anything you wanted to
oh,
add?
Oh, yes. This has been absolutely rich. The contribution just now to Michigan, man, I feel like I'm eating butter pecan ice cream and German chocolate cake or something.
I know what you mean.
Well, one of my questions is that, you know, if she could, what I'm interested in is two things. One, sort of the intellectual thrust of Robeson in terms of, you know, what his vision for blacks was, and also something about the the character of the activism, because one of the one of the statements that your guest from Pasadena made was that you couldn't confront white people. And so the question is, how then, how could activism manifest itself when you couldn't confront?
Okay. Dr. Bridges, you want to take a look hit at that, and then I got some pieces I want to.
I thought maybe the brother made the comment was still on. He's not there.
I think he
is. Still here.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah. How did?
And I'll comment too. Before you comment too, Dan, I want to let you know too, Bill, that the host Danny is born and raised in Durham too.
Okay.
Yeah, he didn't know that. Right.
That's right. Hillside graduate. Yep, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. I know you because, you know, Hillside has a rich history tradition of graduating, you know, people that go on to make great strides in society.
No doubt about
it.
No doubt about it.
Yep. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why I think that I know that people could not... black people could not confront white people,
right?
Especially in the South.
Okay.
Because you could be killed right on the spot.
Right.
You see, when a white person or any person thinks they have this superiority over you, okay, and that's the way they think. That's the way they were. They grew up and they put that in their minds.
Right. Right.
And when you are, a black person, those things you have to be aware of to save your life.
Right.
You know, so that you could go on and meet how they used to meet in secret, so you could meet another day and plan how you can get around that.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why you can't confront those people.
Okay. What you say? What you say, Brother Pugh?
So how did a person like Paul Robeson, how did a person like Paul Robeson confront them then if you had to keep your things to yourself?
What Paul Robeson did, what the lady was talking about, he went and came up with this amendment. You know, when you go to like Congress.
Right. And I think the fact that he had a national...
When you're on the street every day.
Yeah, he had a national approach. And if they would have done anything, I think the hostility, maybe possibly, and the backlash from that against anybody who would have committed violence against him would have shown up there. Like even with King, as you know, he was consistently facing white power. He would go up against Bull Connors, Jim Clark, and so on, and they would, they very rarely beat him in public because it was too much national attention on him, you know. And so I think that might have something
to do with it. That's right, too. When you confront them, you know, nothing is going to happen in your favor anyway.
Right, exactly.
It's what I mean by that, too, because... You know, just say, for instance, you were walking down the street and you looked a white man in his eyes, right?
Right.
And he come and he attack you. You cannot hit that man back. You can't even look in his eyes the way they had that thing, because if you did, you'd be hanging from a tree with a fire burning under your feet.
Exactly. Brother White,
that's how, you had to be smart with that.
Right. Brother White, did I hear your voice just now? Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say they did kill Paul Robeson. It just took him a long time to die.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. That approach. Yeah, you're right. Exactly.
Yeah, in a sense like that, they didn't kill him, in public, like they would do a public hanging.
They did it behind.
Or what they would call a picnic. They didn't do it in that manner.
Exactly.
But what they did it to this man emotionally, financially,
right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, financially, that's how they got to him.
Right.
It kind of reminds me of Marcus Garvey in the Look for Me in the Whirlwind, in the sense of the spirit of Paul Robeson is manifest in people today. And you know, it's interesting, you know, the more that we know about this, I think, you know, the more people will realize that, you know, where, you know, the essence of their own spirit.
Right, so, right.
Yeah.
Good point, yeah.
Brother Lush, yeah, I know sure. you're
one
on.
Thing, I say one thing?
Let me grab this one brother, because we're running toward the end. He's from Montgomery.
Okay.
And I know he came on. Brother Lush, you want to add anything to this conversation? I know you just came on.
Yeah, I tuned in a little late, but I'm going to take advantage of that article by Gilbert King in the Smithsonian. So just good evening to everyone on the phone.
Okay, you mean the one that was in the Smithsonian?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that article is in the, it's the author is Gilbert King, K-I-N-G, and was written September 13, 2011. It's called What Paul Robeson Said. And it's the Smithsonian Magazine. It is online, you know, so you can go in there and look at that, read that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we're at the, unfortunately, the bewitching hour of closing. Any last comments, Brother Bridges, that you might want to have? I'm so happy that you joined us today. I really appreciate that. I missed you. Hope you start coming back on with us. Anything you want to add to that?
Oh, no, not really. I know your time is about up, and I never like to take up all the time, but just to let you know, I do intend to come back next week, and we got Brother Daniel Mack on, and he'll probably tune in again next week, too. And,
okay, great.
And he may be somebody, too, you might want to sometime be able to have on as a guest.
Oh, I'd love to, because he definitely has a base, and my sister from Michigan.
I got his information, and he definitely doesn't mind, because one thing he didn't mention, too, is that when that book came out, 32 Minutes of Greatness, about Hillside High School's basketball program, ESPN came down to your favorite place, Bill, which was my bookstore on Favre Street, to do the video, the television program.
Oh, my
at
goodness.
The bookstore.
Really? Really? Is it on YouTube?
It's a lot
it's called ESPN okay. Pony Express The Vow.
Oh, I got to watch
that. The Vow, B-O-W. So he can pull it up,
I'm going to pull it up, yeah, because it came out Black History Month.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it came out Black History Month in 2004, actually. Right. February 20th is the day it came out.
Well, see, and that's my point. That's the bottom line. We have to write our own history. And that's the whole objective.
You know what? If not, it will not be written. You're
that's right. That's exactly. And that's kind of the whole objective of our program today. Well, listen, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate you so much. And all of those of you who called in and participated, and some of our new people, be sure to join us next week. We're going to talk about Toni Morrison and her legacy and what she left us and kind of get into.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So please join us. We thank you so much. Have a wonderful and productive week. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me, brother.
Yes.